You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Patricia Olenek. Patricia, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, thank you, Brainerd. It's so great to be here.
Let's talk about what you're working on now. I know you're in a show now in New York, so maybe we should start with that and then talk about your other projects. Can you tell me a little bit about what's happening in New York? Because there's a show up right now. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yes, thank you. I'm currently in a two-person exhibition at Baruch College with my friend and Leonardo Education and Art Forum colleague, Ellen K. Levy. And the title of the show is called Some Provocations from Skeptical Inquirers. And it's kind of a fun exhibition. Ellen and I compared notes, and a lot of what she was producing and a lot of what I was producing seemed to align, and in a way that we could riff off of this magazine that you may be aware of, Brainerd, called The Skeptical Inquirer. And it was a magazine that was founded in mid-1970s, and the purpose of the publication was to promote scientific inquiry and examine claims of pseudoscience and science deniers, basically to kind of investigate extraordinary claims of occurrences. And so it's a really interesting publication for that reason. And so we decided to put together a show that that was a kind of convergence of the spirit of this publication. And Ellen and I showed a selection of our work. A lot of her work was confronting disinformation about climate change, and a lot of my work is looking at misguided perceptions of the medicalized body. And, you know, our targets in this exhibition include science deniers and ill-advised diagnoses and treatments and kind of misperceptions of all kinds. So we wanted to explore the consequences of false reasoning while looking critically at some of the historical and contemporary scientific practices. And my own studio practice is an integrated practice, so I'm trying to combine making with thinking with conversations and ideas from laboratories and the methodologies of the sciences. And
let's talk a little bit about the medicalized body. I mean, just to be specific, what kind of things were you addressing, if you can say that? Because the Skeptical Inquirers are a very interesting journal to revive, and I think we could all use more of that today. A kind of debunking of junk science or however you want to call it, but ideas that aren't necessarily based in fact. How did you approach your area of it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I've got a two-pronged answer to that question. Ellen and I actually collaborated on one piece called Scenario Thinking that was a work that was based on the archives of the Skeptical Inquirer itself. So it's a little bit of data visualization, but embedded in the artwork deep enough that it transcends simply a design function. And what the piece does is ask the viewer to consider which categories of human nonsense and pseudoscience have undergone revision, and which of those going to remain persistent over the 20-year time span that we charted. So the one collaborative piece we did addresses those ideas. But my own work tends to address, I try to really look at the way that human interpretation fluctuates between fact and speculation. So my own work, especially in this exhibition, includes large-scale photographs and light boxes of prosthetic devices. And I'm also interested largely in I'll tell you in detail a little bit more after I tell you about the kind of meta perspective. So I'm interested in bioelective enhancement, post-humanism, and working actually with scientific archives. So one body of work, I would say the main body of work that I have in the exhibition is called The Mutable Archive, and it consists of 19 photographs and a large-scale flat panel display of a video performance by three performers. Actually, Ellen K. Levy is one of the performers. Chelsea Knight, New York-based video artist, is a second, and Buzz Spector, artist and a colleague of mine at Washington University, is the third performer. And this piece really was inspired by an experience that I had around 15 years ago when I established a prison arts program in a maximum security penitentiary. And at that time, I became very interested in the scientific study of crime and looking at the history of physiognomy, and these physiognomists and psychiatrists and prison doctors like Cesar Lombroso. These individuals, and he was really the forefather of criminology, he used CalPERS and craniometers to calculate the degree of so-called disproportion of his subjects. And so from that practice, and he was measuring an awful lot of people who were considered to be homo delinquents or criminals, and from that, the study of physiognomy and the early stages of eugenics were born. So kind of, again, starting with that interest of mine from this prison arts program 15 years ago, I revisited a lot of that material when I was a Francis C. Wood Fellow at the College of Physicians in Philadelphia. And the Mutter Museum is attached to that College of Physicians. It was basically a teaching facility for the university in Philly. And during that time, I began photographing a collection of specimens that were collected by another comparative anatomist, Dr. Hertel, who was a 19th century Viennese doctor. And this collection of human skulls has a series of post-mortem inscriptions on the different skull crania. And so I photographed each of these tattoos and their accompanying archive cards. And there's very little, basically what one concludes from just looking at these two aspects of this collection is that very little is known about these anomalous individuals in this collection. We know that many of them had skull shapes that were considered to be anomalous or unusual, but many of them were if you're talking about simply the measures of the features, there was absolutely nothing anomalous about them whatsoever, but the person might have been executed because of criminal activity. So the skulls really attest to the kind of social hierarchies and the reigning regimes of their time. And so even though this collection represents a flawed taxonomy, these collections still fascinate us today, and they're really quintessentially contemporary because the conditions that led them to be acquired in the first place are still alive and well today, and that's really, the linchpin of that is really our preoccupation with difference. So, for the realization...
Our preoccupation, say that again, it's our preoccupation with what?
With difference. So difference. So
difference between people. This kind of cranium measuring and idea that some individual is one human being is different than another human being in terms of
correct. Of
physicality or physiognomy, and that in turn is somehow telling about a disease or illness or capacity or lack of capacity. That's what you mean. Like,
well, actually, it's a great question you're asking. I mean, really, what the physiognomists were trying to do is to look at the proportion of the head and try and ascribe personality features based on these measurements. And this is why it became a kind of early form of eugenics and why, for example, if you had a broad brow or a hook nose, the taxonomy from these collections might deduce, based on those physical features, that you might be predisposed to a certain kind of criminal activity. For example, if you had a hooked nose, maybe you were predisposed to theft. If you had a broad brow and a high forehead, maybe you were predisposed to murder. So this is what the physiognomists were trying to do, is ascribe personality traits to the anomalies that they were trying to pull out of these specimens. So it's a very odd collection, and though we look at it and we say, okay, we understand this to be flawed, it doesn't make any sense, and, you know, science has advanced beyond this, there still are scientists today that are trying to look at physical, biological data as it relates to behavior. This is still a very controversial but not unpopular area of study. So getting back to this archive that I was working with, I thought, well, this is really curious. So little is known about these there was something like 187 skulls, I think, in the collection, or maybe 137. And I've selected 19, and what I've decided to do is commission a series of writers, and these writers include artists, scholars, historians, medical ethicists. I even have a spiritual medium and an opera singer who is in line, each to write their own speculative biography for a chosen subject within this collection. So the idea being that each writer looks at the archival data, and they factor in the factual errors, the personal biases, they follow their own conjecture and longing, and then they engage in their own processes of history and identity construction. And it really brings to light the controversy surrounding the display of human remains, first of all, but also the restoration of personhood and individuality and humanness of each of the subjects in this collection. So Buzz Spector, Ellen Levy, and Chelsea Knight are the first three writers in this series. And Buzz's piece, The Dutch Suicide, starts with asking us to imagine the skull sutures as fault lines in the plate tectonics of the brain. The doctors who cut through the skull in search of relief for this brain or that recognize that assuaging one pain might instigate another. And his piece ends by saying that doctors offered the subject analgesics, and one day an old woman next door told her to stare at the sea and empty her mind of its prickly baggage, and in the gray Dutch weather it was impossible to tell the difference between sea and sky. The waves lapped against the dike invitingly. So with Buzz's subject, he speculates that she took her own life because of prefrontal sutures in the brain that didn't fuse correctly at some point in her life. So each person speculates and writes and puts together an amazing story about one of the subjects in this collection. And again, it's just each creates their own level of research, speculation, poetry, and they're really, really powerful readings. So I have three of the 19 finished at this point. And
so what is finished? How does that look in a finished statement, the writing and images?
Oh, good question. It will exist in several different forms. Right now, if you go to Baruch, you'll see three of the video vignettes back to back, and they've all gone through a pretty elaborate post-production filming. So you'll see Buzz Spector, you'll hear the audio of Chelsea and Ellen. And so this currently exists as a video piece, and it will also exist as an artist book when all of the scripts are written. And it is my hope that I'll be able to get enough of the readers together in one city to do a live performance. But I need to get more readers in the series at this point. It's taken about 1 year to get three of the readings completed in video form, so it's a pretty time-intensive project.
That does sound like one, but also an exciting one. Just the collaborative aspect of that is so exciting, what different people bring to it in terms of their own writing and imagining.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And the stories that people are speculating are, you know, they some some sort of delve into something that feels more like magic realism. Another one delves into the kind of historical facts that would have shaped the lives of the people in this collection. For example, Ellen's subject is Francesca Sikora, who is a very well-celebrated Viennese prostitute who died at the age of 19 from meningitis. Chelsea Knight's subject is Veronica Huber, who we know very little about, but we do know that she was executed from having murdered her child. And Buzz Spector is writing about a Dutch suicide whose prefrontal sutures seemed to be causing her sufficient discomfort to allow us to speculate that she might have thrown herself into the Grey Dutch Sea to alleviate or to assuage her pain. So what one speculates in taking on one of these subjects is fascinating, illuminating, and with the archive cards themselves, you see that they've been written over over the period of time. So the original people who documented factual information about these people, that factual information is being questioned later. And this tells us that information is tacit and that that history is slippery. And so a lot gets teased out.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. I mean, history is slippery and you know, scientific facts, so to speak, is slippery. I was just doing an interview the other day with Lynn Gamwell, and she wrote a book on art and mathematics, and there was two books that she was frustrated that I even mentioned. One was Fritjof Capra's The Tao of Physics, and the other is P.D. Uspensky's book, In Search of the Miraculous, which I brought up to her at a later date, which she said both are complete junk science. There's not like a word of truth in either one or even an interpretation that's interesting. It's just, you know, not in her mind, but she feels the scientific community regards those books as populist junk that doesn't actually make sense. She said, however, you know, that book became a bestseller. You know, both books were enormously popular, and everybody believes them, and that research has already been reproduced endlessly. So it's almost, and as a scientist, she feels, as I interpreted it, that it's frustrating that it's out of the bag already. And even if there were 20 magazines, yeah. Like the Skeptical Inquirer, it wouldn't matter. Nobody's listening anymore anyway, because it's so you know, prominent in the public consciousness, which is interesting, right? There's no way to even battle that now, it seems.
Absolutely. And the kinds of information that we've, you know, accepted at face value that needs to be re-questioned, you know, again, requires a kind of critical thinking that revisits and revises, and how one revisits the pseudoscience of physiognomy is a very interesting one, because again, it's kind of common knowledge that this is bunk science, but at the same time, today's science is looking at behavior through the scientific imaging of the brain rather than the skull, and they're looking at blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, which could suggest the difference between a subject that has a strong sense of conscience and a subject who doesn't, but it could also simply suggest that, you know, one subject has more blood flow to the front of the brain. So again, it's sort of producing data, but it's incredibly controversial because, of course, you know, the nature-nurture argument is a very controversial one, and I think science is probably hesitant to say it's strictly biological, although there are proponents of that idea and others who are hesitant to say it's strictly nurture, it's strictly the way that you've been reared, because it's kind of, I think, commonly accepted that there's a little of both in the way that we come up through the world, or a lot of both. And I guess the question remains for me is, can absolutely everything that needs to be known be imaged or be collected or be measured? And I think with the scientific instruments that we have, you know, especially with the imaging technologies, that these technologies fundamentally change some pretty charged social and political debates of our time, and I expect that this will continue as we move forward.
I expect so too. So you're working on other projects as well that I'd like to get to. Can you tell me a little bit about the other projects that you're working on?
Absolutely. I am working on the second installment of a piece I'm really excited about that's another collaboration with a colleague of mine here at Washington University in St. Louis, where I have an academic appointment. And my colleague, Sung-ho Kim, who with his wife Heather Wooster run Axiomi, which is a design architecture firm, and one of my former students who is a sound designer, and a second student who is a video artist, Adam Hogan, we put together a piece called Dark Skies, which is a multi-sensory collaboration. And it was shown at UCLA a couple of years ago in their California Nanosystems Institute. I've actually done quite a bit of work with Victoria Vesna at UCLA. She's been a co-organizer with me on a symposium on art in the brain, and I will be an artist in residence at UCLA this fall, and we'll be able to develop a little bit more of the Dark Skies project. But basically, it's motivated by the existence of light pollution. I can't say inspired by, because light pollution isn't something to be inspired by, but
right.
Light pollution motivated me to make the piece. And light pollution is defined by the International Dark Sky Association as an excessive amount of obtrusive artificial light. And as we know, this obtrusive amount of light affects our sleeping and our feeding patterns. It affects our brainwave activity. I always also like to tell people that if they have nocturnal pets like hamsters, they will not do well if you leave the lights on. So we need darkness. I mean, as human organisms, as animal organisms, we need darkness. And so the work takes as its title an astronomical reference, which refers to remote places free of hazy city light. And the meaning of the piece is also that we might have an extended view into deep space and time as a unique perceptual and psychological experience. So this piece actually began by my thinking about how light pollution is negatively impacting Earth as a place from which to observe our environment. And what we did was we took a scanning electron micrograph that I took myself in a laboratory at the University of Michigan of a wild mouse taste bud, and we began producing data sets to produce a very detailed sculptural wall that could be used as a video screen, as a kind of lenticular video screen. And the final work is a 8x8 foot wall that shows a multi-channel video projection. One video shows, or it's a reproduction or an animation of a crepuscular sky. And the other sky is a dark sky with these kind of milky cosmos or metaverses slipping across the surface. So you have both of these videos hitting the sculptural wall at these raking angles. So it has a real lenticular effect if you stand.
Yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit, so that everybody understands the lenticular effect. The lenticular effect, if I understand it, is kind of like what used to be called wiggle vision or something. If you have a 2D lenticular image, when you move it, it could be like the equivalent of a person winking at you or an image that shifts and changes because there's actually two images printed on there in a very particular fashion. Is that correct?
Precisely. That's exactly
okay.
The meaning of
so lenticular, lenticular so video. I was going to ask you about that, but you're about to explain it. But a lenticular video is what exactly?
Well, it basically means that when you project the video at a very steep angle from one side of the piece, the video only hits the dimensional surfaces on that side. So if you have a video projector pulled very far to the right, for example, of this dimensional wall, and the video is only catching the right sides of all of the dimensional things on that wall, and likewise you take a projector and you shoot the other video at a very steep angle from the left, then when you stand in the center and you look at the wall, all of the left sides of the dimensional forms will be hit with one video, and all the right sides will be hit with another. So the effect as you move through the space from the left to the right is that the image shifts and changes. And the image is already shifting and changing even if you stand in the middle, because after all, we're not looking at static images, we're looking at videos. So to complicate matters even further, there is a two-channel audio track that goes with this. And this is a piece that I worked on with, the sound I worked on with Chris Ottinger. And basically the two soundtracks possess their own unique characteristics. They're based on raw sound files that I captured at twilight in the Rocky Mountains during a residency at the Banff Center for the Arts. And one emphasizes lower frequencies or deep rumbling sounds that happen at nighttime. And these tend to produce the effect that the viewer is shrinking or shrunk down to a kind of a minuscule scale. And the other could be described in terms of a macro view or a zooming out of the world, because the sounds are very high-pitched. So again, as you move through the space, depending on where you're standing, both the sound and the visual components are different, but they provide the viewer with an embodied experience, and the sound elements are being projected directionally into the exhibition space. They literally allow the viewers to be able to migrate between micro and macro realms. And that's really what the piece is doing. It's giving you a kind of meditative embodied experience of micro and macro worlds. And the whole piece is about the transition to darkness. And this piece eventually does go dark and then lights up again. And it's I think pretty captivating as an 8x8 foot piece. I think it would be even more so if it was a more immersive experience. So this will be my project when I'm on sabbatical this fall at UCLA, is to continue this project.
That's wonderful. I'm so glad you were able to describe that. That you know, of all the things that I've talked to people about and described, or they've had to describe, you know, imaging a lenticular video with, you know, a soundtrack that's on top of it and all these layers is pretty impressive. In an interview with Patricia, that wasn't an easy thing to describe, and you did a great job, because I've never heard of a lenticular video before. Of course, I've heard of lenticular images, but the idea of all that happening at once is pretty fascinating. That sounds like a great project. So as you continue to work on it on your sabbatical, that will be the post-production work on that and putting it all together?
No, it's a really good question. Sorry to interrupt. The continuation of the project will be, first of all, trying to produce the CNC, because basically the wall is CNC routed from architectural foam, and these take forever to produce. This is something that Sung Ho Kim and Axiomi were working with me on at the School of Architecture at WashU. We put these 4x8, 6-inch thick pieces of architectural foam down, and then CNC routed these dimensional surfaces that were based loosely on the wild mouse taste bud. And by tessellating the patterns and putting them side by side, we were able to piece together an 8x8 foot wall. So really moving forward will be more materials investigations, so that we can produce something that's more light and transportable for other exhibitions, but also something that will allow the viewer to be in a completely embodied environment. So rather than being simply situated in front of an 8x8 foot wall,
they might actually be in a space where all the walls are covered with these projections. So it's an ambitious project, but one that I hope I can eventually come to, maybe by December. Fingers crossed.
I love that. And have lenticular videos been made before like that? I've never heard of it, but have they?
Well, the effect is lenticular. The video is a standard video. So the fact that you have...
Right, no, I understand you're projecting onto a surface, and maybe just so everybody understands, I'll just reiterate, but there's a surface with, you know, at the very least a whole series of raised bumps on them, let's say. And when you project from one angle, we're looking, it's hitting one side of those bumps and the other side, you know, the other angle of those bumps. And, you know, I believe the way images are made is like they're these kind of long triangles, right, that are running down the image in those kind of old lenticular images, so that one clear side of the triangle is lit and the other side of the triangle is lit. But I've never heard I know it's not the video, it's the projection surface, but has that been done before? Have you seen other examples of that? Because I've just never heard of that.
You know, I can't say that I recall going through any recent contemporary exhibition where this has been the case. I do know that other artists are doing projection mapping on two-dimensional surfaces, and this has been done. You know, this happens a lot at you even get people like Tony Orsler, who's really using a lot of masking with projections. Krzysztof Ladyczko is really using straight up high-resolution projection on buildings. But there are artists who will project, for example, onto a dimensional surface, and they will then make that dimensional surface activate in a certain way, and there's special software that can be used. So I think I looked at what was happening in the contemporary art world and what was how artists were using different technologies. And then, of course, you take all of this knowledge back into your own play space, and you start playing with projectors and playing with projections, and you start to come up with these ideas through the process of manipulating materials in the studio. And I think that's what's so exciting about sort of, I don't want to sound too preternatural or something, but sort of protecting the kind of sanctity of what happens in the studios when you do come upon these kinds of resolutions to projects. It's very exciting, and one can't really get to that through the research process necessarily, but it's really through the process of play and material play in the studio that allowed me to come to that conclusion. So no, there's not a single source I can point to that that I would say really inspired the project. Yeah.
But interesting that you spoke about those other ideas, because they're all ways of, it's true, working in different forms. Is there one other project that we didn't talk about, but I believe a third project that you're working on?
Yeah, I do have all of these different strands moving forward. The third project is one that may or may not be coming to an end. It depends on whether or not I continue to mine the archive from the College of Physicians. But it's a body of work that, again, visitors to Baruch College in the Sydney Mishkin Gallery would be able to see. And this is also part of the archive series from the Motor Museum. And it's really, its starting point is really on how the brain constructs an image of the body and the kind of perceptual phenomena of phantoms. So I think you're probably aware individuals who've lost a limb almost without exception experience something called the phantom limb syndrome. And that's the vivid impression that the missing limb is present. And remarkably, actually, MRIs and MEGs are able to visualize changes in the cortical topography in the sensory neurons of the brain, and to read the brain's neuroplastic qualities while people are actually experiencing the phantom limb syndrome. And a lot of work has been done about this by a lot of different research scientists, but most notably by V.S. Ramachandran and William Herstein. And so in a kind of macabre reversal of this missing limb phenomena, I produced two large-scale photographs titled Isomorphic Extension 1 and 2, And these portray two prosthetic legs which seem to linger or float underneath a phantom body. And the very absence of the body demands a weird kind of attention to this piece. So the two prosthetic legs are kind of amusingly unmatched. One is from the 19th century and one is from the 20th century. One is male and the other is female. And yet they sit in space side by side and imply a phantom body. And from that, you see that the phantom body is both the subject of the work, or the phantoms, the phantom body is part of the subject of the work, but that also the work operates almost like a little bit of a scientific experiment. I find when I get the right distance from the piece that I do begin to imagine the phantom body. So, and I think this speaks to...
So as the viewer starts to kind of fill it in, almost like the phantom limb experience, they start filling in the body, sort of.
Exactly. And I find this very strange. I myself did not articulate this at first, but I had enough people in my studio, and after a couple of curators actually said that this was the kind of strange affect of this piece, I began to think, that's really curious. What is it about the human mind that desires to see the body whole? And what is that desire for wholeness in our lives? In one way, and it's a kind of a funny piece. So these legs suggest, a kind of ambulation, or they suggest a little bit of a kind of autopoiesis. Are these legs kind of coming together of their own volition? Could they kick? All sorts of kind of fun questions come to mind with the piece, but it really does operate in a very, very strange way. And there is one book that I have yet to read, but I know focuses on this topic by Kaja Silverman, called Flesh of My Flesh. And it's really, I guess she's one of the more celebrated literary and cultural critics of our time, but she's really looking at wholeness and how things relate to one another as a kind of larger metastructure in our lives. So I think that again, how wholeness as a concept is sort of embedded in our cognition, in our perception, and in our own kind of mental construct of how we form our lives is really interesting to me, and it is something that I think the Phantom Limb series does represent quite nicely.
Yeah, I think so too. That's such an interesting idea. In closing, there'll be links in this so that people can hopefully come to your show at Baruch before it closes and see other work of yours. I've been asking people what book they're reading lately. Is there a book you're reading that you want to share? This could be on any topic. Could be what we were talking about. I imagine you read so much on that. But is there anything that you're reading now that you want to share with us?
Well, it's a really good question because I have to say I tend to read parts of books. As those parts relate to my own interest in research. So it's a great question. This summer I'm determined to get to Julia Kristeva's The Severed Head. That's kind of funny because of all the work that I'm doing with these collections of heads. But in this book she turns a critical eye to the study of the human head as a symbol and a metaphor. So I'll be interested to get into that. And another book that I just bought at an artist auction at the Luminary here in St. Louis is The Futurist Cookbook, because I'm really interested in how art and food come together. So those would be the two books I'm going to be biting into this summer, if you excuse the bad pun.
That sounds good. The Futurist Cookbook, it's something that I've looked at a while ago, but now I think I should look at it again. That'll be a very fun read for you this summer, I think.
I think so, especially as it talks about the dangers of pasta. This is something I can relate to, is the dangers of pasta, but probably their dangers and my dangers are two different kinds of dangers, but I must investigate more fully.
That's exciting. Patricia, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure to learn more about your practice and discuss it.
Oh, absolutely my pleasure, and thank you so much, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.